many of you know, December is a time when an overwhelming amount of generosity flows from the American public to worthy nonprofit organizations like Yeshiva University. And we have tried very hard over the last year to provide a taste of YU to the Long Island community in the form of lunch and learns such as these, the Community Beit Medrash, which we've now had two semesters of the Young Israel of Lawrence Cedarhurst, a series of Shabbatonim with YU scholars, a continuing legal education program which kicked off last week, and others that are planned for 2023. So I will just take a moment and shamelessly plug YU in my role as the Senior Director of YU's Long Island region. Thank many of you in this room for your generous support of YU. We have a number of friends here who have been consistent, generous supporters of Yeshiva University for many years. I thank you for that. For those of you who are not yet generous supporters of YU, I invite you to take this opportunity to do so between now and December the 31st. We have over 300 young men and women studying at YU's undergraduate colleges from Long Island. It's a tremendous number of people. YU supports that endeavor greatly by contributing something in the neighborhood of $9 million in undergraduate scholarships, both need-based and merit-based, to those 300 people. So we're very committed to Long Island, and thank God Long Island is very committed to YU. And my job is to make sure that we do everything that we can to strengthen that commitment, both in terms of community programming and also in terms of giving everybody the opportunity to participate in giving stock at YU to the extent that you can. So thank you very much for your generous support. And now, without further ado, you're here to hear Rabbi Leibowitz, not Alan Sechter. So let me just read this bio, if I may, because it's an impressive bio. Rabbi Aryeh Leibowitz holds the Abraham Arbisfeld Chair of the Director of the Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik Smicha Program at REITS, and also serves as the Mora d'Astra of Beis HaKnesses of North Woodmere. He was previously a Rabbi at Landers College for Men and DRS, and is an alum of the Yeshiva of South Shore, where I have three sons. Rabbi Leibowitz grew up in the Five Towns community and spent 2 years learning at Yeshiva Kerem Yavna before attending YU's Seisim School of Business. He has published numerous articles on practical topics in various journals, including several in the Journal of Halacha and Contemporary Society. He is a prolific speaker with a global following. I googled Rabbi Leibowitz today. He has more than 10,000 shiurim on YU Torah. If that's not, you know, the number one spot, it must be. We're very fortunate to have him here today to talk about the true symbol of Hanukkah. Please help me to welcome Rabbi Leibowitz.
Thank you very much. Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you so much for coming to learn together this afternoon, this Hanukkah afternoon. So I wasn't sure what the topic should be. I'm never sure what the topic should be when I'm asked to speak here. So I don't remember who it was, whoever reached out to me to speak. Maybe it was Rabbi Winston, went to my shiurim online, and he said, how about this one? And he chose one, and the topic was the true symbol of Hanukkah. But then this morning, I was feeling that I didn't want to pull out an old shiur and give a repeat. So we're going to talk about something else related to Hanukkah. I don't think anyone came because they really needed to know the true symbol of Hanukkah. I assume you came because you wanted to learn Torah together. So we'll learn Torah together about Hanukkah. Now, Hanukkah, just the name Hanukkah, is a little bit of an anomaly in terms of Jewish holidays. You know, when it comes to Jewish holidays, very rarely do you have the name of the holiday signify or be merames to, hint to, the date of the holiday in the name itself. The Tikkuni Zohar writes that Chanukah, Vaday Ihu Chanukah, Chanu Chaf Hei. That Chanukah is really a combination of two words, Chanu, that they rested and that they were victorious on Chaf Hei, on the 25th day of Kislev. I don't know, do we have that elsewhere? I didn't go through all of the Jewish holidays in my mind, yeah? Tu Bishvat, okay, yeah, that's just descriptive. Yes, but Rosh Hashanah, okay. Pesach, Purim, there's no allusion to the name, and especially when you're dealing with a Yom Tov Midrabanan. A Yom Tov Midrabanan, the impression that you get is that the date's not really something that's inherently important. It's just when the miracle happened, as opposed to a Yom Tov Midoraisa, where God wrote the Torah before He created the world. It makes sense that the date would be inherently important, that the date would be something that God had already put into place before the world began. So I wanted to explore maybe a little bit more about the meaning or the value or the history of Chaf Hei Kislev. What is it about that date that makes it so appropriate for Hanukkah? And see maybe if it goes back even before Chanukah, before the Chanukah story, where Chaf Hei Kislev plays a role. Now, Chanukah also means a chinuch. It means the consecration. And it was the chinuch of the Mikdash, when we were able to reconsecrate the Beis HaMikdash. When we go back to the first Chanukah Sabayis, it was not in Bayis Sheni, nor in Bayis Rishon, it was by the Mishkan. When the Mishkan was built, Moshe Rabbeinu had suggested, there's a well-known Rashi that goes through this whole conversation, Moshe Rabbeinu had suggested, let's first build all the Kalim of the Mishkan, and then we'll build the structure, we'll build the ohel within which to put the kelim. And Bezalel said, that doesn't make any sense. You're going to build all these kelim, and then you know what you're going to have? You're going to have storage fees. You're going to have to find somewhere to put them. I have a sister who lives in Ramat Eshkol, and Bli Ayin Hara, she has 12 children, so she's trying to move to a larger apartment. So she has that they had a builder in Israel. You know, the builder says it will be done, the apartment will be done, new place will be done in a year and a half. So my parents helped her buy all of these appliances and everything for the new apartment. It is now 5 years later, and all those, so storage fees, they already paid for them. The storage fees were more expensive than the appliances themselves. It's a silly thing to do. But Moshe Rabbeinu makes that suggestion that we should take the appliances first, build all the kalim first, and then we'll build the ohel. And Bezalel says, no, don't do that. That doesn't make any sense. Bezalel says, build the ohel first, build the structure, and then fill the structure with the kelim. And Moshe Rabbeinu says, wow, Shema, Bezalel, Kela, Yisa, you must have been in the shadow of God that you were able to come up with such a brilliant idea. I mean, really? So brilliant? How did Moshe Rabbeinu miss something like that? What was Moshe Rabbeinu thinking when Moshe Rabbeinu says to build the kelim first? And not only that, you know, the end of the story makes it seem like so Bezalel wins that round, right? Moshe Rabbeinu makes one suggestion, Bezalel makes another, and Moshe says, Bezalel, that's brilliant. So it sounds like Bezalel wins that, you know, that debate. But if you look at what actually happens in the end when it comes to putting the Mishkan together, Bezalel's suggestion didn't really make sense, because the Mishkan was completed months earlier, and they didn't erect the Mishkan. They didn't put it up, they didn't actually use it until months after it was done. So guess what? Everything was in storage anyway. So Bezalel was saying, oh, we got to build the structure first and then build the kelim, because what are we going to do with the kelim? In the end of the day, they built the structure, they kept it in storage. It was boards that they didn't put together, and they had the boards in storage. Then they built the kelim, they had that in storage, and it went months and months till they built it. So what exactly is that whole conversation between Bezalel and Moshe? And then maybe a third question, because I always like to do things in three questions. When it came time to build the second Beis HaMikdash, the Navi Chagai, if you ever learned the Sefer Chagai, it's a very easy Sefer to learn, both in terms of the fact that it's only two prakim long, so it's very, very short. Just a couple of weeks ago, in my shul, there was a group of people that are learning Sefer Tanya from the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, and they had completed Sefer Tanya. And there was a whole another group of people that are learning Mishneh Yomi, and they had completed Seder Zra'im in Mishneh Yomi. So I got up to speak, and on Shabbos morning I said Mazel Tov to those who finished Tanya, Mazel Tov to those who finished Seder Zra'im, and Mazel Tov to everyone for finishing Sefer Ovadia, because that week's Haftorah was the entirety of Sefer Ovadia. There are like these little svarim in Tanakh, particularly in the Treyasar, that are not hard to learn, these tiny little svarim. So Sefer Ovadia is only one parak. Sefer Chagai is two prakim long. It's also very easy to learn because it's a really nice Navi. Meaning a lot of times Navi'im are frustrating. The Navi comes and he gives Musar and he says everyone's misbehaving and everyone just ignores the Navi, tries to kill the Navi, doesn't care about what the Navi is saying, continues to sin. Chagai like says, everyone be better, and they say, yeah, we will, and they do, and it's like a really nice, that's why it's so short, there's nothing to tell. Everyone just actually listen to the Navi, you know, maybe as a rabbi, I don't know, that resonates with me, that like such a pleasurable read that he gives Musar and everyone just listens. But when Chagai gives his Musar, it's during the time period when it came time to build the second Beis HaMikdash. And Chagai tells people several times the following phrase. He says, Simu levavchem al darchechem. Place your hearts on your path. And he says it twice within three psukim. There's something that he's telling them to do more than a construction project. He's telling them, simu levavchem al derchechem. So I want to try to figure out, what exactly is that? What does that mean? So again, three questions. Question number one is there something about the date Chaf Hei Kislev other than the coincidence of that's when the Hanukkah miracle happened to have taken place? Question number two, what are we to make of the whole conversation between Moshe Rabbeinu and Bezalel about building the Mishkan, where Moshe first suggests to build the Kelim first, and then Bezalel says, no, you got to build the Ohel first, and then at the end of the day, everything remained in storage anyway? And question number three, what does Chagai mean when he continuously says, Simu levavchem al darchechem? So I heard the following idea from Rabbi Yisrael Reisman in the name of Rav Druk, where he says the following. What's the original significance of the particular date of the 25th day of Kislev? Now, it's understood, of course, to be the day of the miracle of Hanukkah, but it really, really has a much more ancient history. There's a medrash that records the original significance of the date. Yalkut, it says as follows. Amar Rabbi Chanina, b'chaf hei b'kislev, nigmara melechas ha-mishkan. On the 25th day of Kislev, the work in the preparation of the Mishkan was completed. They finished preparing all of the kelim, all of the boards, the krashim and the aron and the shulchan. Everything was done by Chaf Hei Kislev. How did that happen? Moshe Rabbeinu came down from Har Sinai on Yom Kippur, after the second Luchos, right? He came down on Yom HaKippurim, and when he came down, he took up a collection, and he announced, we're going to be doing a collection for the Mishkan, and Jews responded generously and immediately, as Jews do, and within 2 days, they had more than enough. Hamalacha ha'isadayim, they had more than that, as much as they needed within 2 days of a fundraising campaign, that everything they needed, and they got to work right away. By Sukkot time already, they were ready to get to work, and by Chanukah, by Chaf Hei Kislev, they were finished. The work was done. Then it came time to erect the Mishkan, to actually just put it up. I mean, that was just a matter of putting it together. You hire the guys who build your sukkah, and they'll put together the Mishkan. How long does that take? They do like 10 houses in a day, 10 sukkahs in a day, right? So how long is that going to take already? You would imagine it would happen like the next day. Chavav Kislev? I don't know. That's when you would imagine that the actual Hakamas HaMishkan would happen. But no, it waits until Rosh Chodesh Nisan. You know, think about that. When's Rosh Chodesh Nisan? It's 2 weeks before Pesach. Right? If you're thinking, you're standing here today, you know, people tend to get anxiety around Pesach coming. But not yet, right? Meaning no one's feeling the Pesach anxiety just yet because it's so far away. That's how long they waited until Rosh Chodesh Nisan to put up the Mishkan. For 7 days before Rosh Chodesh, they had the Yemei HaMiluim, where Moshe Rabbeinu acted as the interim Kohen Gadol, and they put it up and took it down and put it up. And then finally, Rosh Chodesh Nisan, that's the day that it was there, that it was going to be put up and it was going to be used. It was business as usual with the Mishkan starting Rosh Chodesh Nisan. That means between Chanukah and 2 weeks before Pesach, the Mishkan was in storage. And Chazal say the people were confused. They didn't know what was happening. You make this whole collection. We responded immediately, like that. And we're there, and we're donating, and everything's, and the malacha happens, and people make it happen. And then what? Then you're just waiting, and nothing's going on? V'nishar mekupal, say Chazal. It remained folded up somewhere. Alecha Nisan, v'yu Yisrael meranin in al Moshe lemar. And the Jewish people started complaining to Moshe Rabbeinu, and they said, "Lama lohu kama mishkan miyad? Why don't you put up the mishkan right away? Shema dofi yirabanu? Did we do something wrong? Did we do some sort of aveira that prevents the mishkan from being put up? Va'kodesh baruch hu chishev la'akev simchas mishkan al chodesh nol b'yitzchak." But Hashem had a plan. Hashem wanted; he thought it would be most appropriate to put up the mishkan in the month that Yitzchak was born. So he was holding off until Nisan. And what emerges is that the people weren't told about this. It was Hashem's plan all along that the Mishkan was going to wait for months. No one knew that. the people weren't informed in advance. Look, here's the timeline on the project, and we're going to put this into use Rosh Chodesh Nisan. You know, and it just happened. And the Medrash continues. Well, wait a second. If it really was completed on Chaf Hei Kislev, and Hashem had a plan to move it to Nisan, Me'ata Hifsid Kislev. Nebuchan Kislev. Why does Kislev have to lose out? It was a date that was ready to have the Chanukah Samishkan, and now it had to lose out because the Chanukah Samishkan was moved to Nisan. Amar Kodesh Baruch Hu Alay L'Shalim Lo. Hashem says, don't worry, I keep score of everything. You know, he's got a complicated calculus up in Shemayim of how to make everything even, how to give everything. He said, I keep score. Don't worry, I'm going to pay back Kislev. And how does he pay back Kislev? Comes many, many centuries later with Chanukah. That Chanukah happens on Kislev. Mashlimin lo Chanukas hachashmonayim. Now, the reason we have the Chanukas hachashmonayim and Chafei Kislev, according to this Medrash, is that that's the date that should have been the Chanukas HaMishkan 1,000 years earlier. And 1,000 years later, it finally happens. Why couldn't Moshe Rabbeinu tell the people in advance that this was the plan? What was going on? Why is it that they had to wait and they ha'amiranin in Acher Moshe, that they had to complain to Moshe? So to give some context to this, it seems that there was a purposeful manufacturing of a desire on behalf of Klal Yisrael, that Hashem wanted Klal Yisrael dafka to not have instant gratification. He wanted Klal Yisrael to wait, to beg, to complain, to anticipate, to hope for, to yearn for, and that was critical to the Mishkan. The hoping for something, developing what we call in Hebrew a tshuka, a yearning, and not happening, that was fundamental to the Mishkan. And that's why, that may be the conversation with Moshe and Bezalel. Bezalel says, Bezalel didn't know. He didn't know that it was going to be in storage anyway. And Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't tell him. It was his secret with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. So Moshe Rabbeinu says, oh yeah, Bitzel Kel Yisa. You were, it's a great idea. You're right. We should build the structure first. Because Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't tell him. No, there's no sense in building the structure first. Because the whole structure is going to be sitting in storage also. He couldn't say anything. So he says, okay, you're right. We'll build it first. It doesn't matter. It's all going to be in storage anyway. Because the whole point was to develop and create. HaKadosh Baruch Hu was trying to manufacture this tshuka, this desire on behalf of Klal Yisrael. And it wasn't just the Mishkan. This same thing repeated itself in history. And this is like remarkable. This seems fundamental to the way every mikdash was built. You know, we think we're waiting for the third Beis HaMikdash. You know, we say in Shemona, I say, Machzir Shechinasa L'Tzion, and we picture in our minds, as we're saying, a Machzir Shechinasa L'Tzion, a Beis HaMikdash on Har HaBayis. We were fortunate enough, I was just in Eretz Yisrael last week, to see the Makom of Har HaBayis. I don't see it from up close, I see it from afar, but we see the Makom of Har HaBayis, and we picture in our minds where that dome is. We picture the Beis HaMikdash returning. And we think that we're the first ones to wait and to hope and to yearn and to... It's fundamental to every mikdash. Let me explain. Bayis Rishon. Who built Bayis Rishon, the first Beis HaMikdash? Shlomo HaMelech. But there's a history to that. Nasan HaNavi tells David HaMelech, you're going to build the Beis HaMikdash. David HaMelech is dying to build the Beis HaMikdash. It's all he wants to do. And Nasan HaNavi says, great idea! Do it! He tells him, he gives him the go-ahead. The Navi gave him the go-ahead. And you know what David did? He had a fundraising campaign. He put together all the materials. He did it. He started doing everything. And then Nasan HaNavi, stop work order. Nasan HaNavi has to come back and say, sorry, my bad. You're not allowed to do it yet. This, in fact, you're never going to be able to do it. You're going to have to wait another generation until it comes. So there was all this anticipation, all this excitement to Klal Yisrael. Another generation. You're going to have to wait. There's, again, that waiting period. Go to Bayis Sheni, in the times of Bayis Sheni. The book of Ezra teaches us explicitly, just in the Pesukim itself, you read the Pesukim at the beginning of Ezra. Klal Yisrael was told to build the Bayis Sheni. Yeshayahu HaNavi had said to them that there's going to be a king named Koresh, and he's going to allow you to build. And when there's a king named Koresh, and he allows you to build, that's when you build. And sure enough, there's a Persian king named Koresh, and he says, go and build the Bayis Sheni. And 42,000 people uproot their lives and leave Bavel and go to Eretz Yisrael to build the Bayis Sheni. And they dig a foundation for the Bayis Sheni. The Nevi'im, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi were there and gave them permission to go ahead with the project and to bring karbanos already before the Bayis Sheni was even built. They allowed them to bring karbanos because they had a parah adumah, so they were able to be tarred. And they started bringing karbanos and they started building. And then, suddenly, this King Koresh, who the Navi told them was supposed to give them the permission and had given the permission, stop work order. One day, some guy shows up and says, stop work order. King Koresh says he can't do it. For how long? 18 years. 18 years after the project had started. Now, we're used to this in Israel with the builders that are building my sister's apartment, but that's what happened with the Beis HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash. 18 years. So not only the Mishkan, but Bayis Rishon, Bayis Sheni also had a start and a stop, which created just more of a burning desire, more of a yearning, and only later, after that yearning was created, was it actually built. Says Rav Druk, this is the Yesod of Chanukah. The Yesod of Chanukah, the idea of Chanukah, is to generate a tshuka gedola la'avodas Hashem, to build within us a great desire to serve God. The Binyan Mikdash is on the foundation of desire, a real critical desire to Hashra'as HaShechina. You know, and that is, to me, is a fascinating idea. The value of not just achieving something, the value of wanting something, the value of yearning for something. You know, when God wanted to introduce Adam to Chava, He didn't just introduce Adam to Chava. He didn't just one day have Adam go to sleep and create Chava. What happened? Adam had to look around at all of the other creatures that were created. And he saw male and he saw female. And he said, oh, okay, everyone has a match. And then Adam looked at himself and he felt, I'm missing something. I don't have a match. And it's only then that God introduces Adam to Chava. In order to create the sense of creating a bias that is a basis, that is a foundation for Hashra'as HaShechina, which we know a Jewish home is. Ish v'isha, the Gemara tells us, when there's Shalom Beinehem, the Yud from Ish and the Hey from Isha combine to create a Hashra'as HaShechina, a sense of God's presence. It's a miniature Mishkan. In order to have that, there had to be a desire that was created. It couldn't just be, oh, here's Chava. Oh, I like her. This is great. There had to be something missing. It's part of the human experience to feel that sense of yearning, that sense of lacking, that sense of something missing. You know, there's a halach in Hilchos Avelos that, yeah, how are you Menachem Avel? You go, lo aleinu, right? You go to a shiva house. So what do? You go and you just talk about the Yankees. You distract them. You know, talk about a new movie that's coming out. Talk about your next vacation or their last vacation and next vacation. You're not allowed to do that. You're not supposed to do that. There's an iser for the avel to be masiach das from the avelus, to take his mind off of the avel is supposed to be focused on the avelus. They're supposed to be talking about who they lost. Now that's so painful, though. That's so painful. What, you know, we always say Judaism has got mourning right, right? Meaning we M O U R N I N G, right? We understand how mourning should work. Is that really, though? Isn't it painful to focus? Yeah, it's painful, but it's a good kind of painful. Meaning, a person wouldn't feel fulfilled if they spent a week distracting themselves. They want to feel close to the person that they lost, and the way to feel close is to build that sense and to lean in to that sense of yearning, that sense of tshuka, that sense of missing somebody. Yeah, it's a lousy feeling, but it's also a really good feeling. Because it means that you feel a certain sense of closeness. There's a certain fondness, a certain ahava that's created when there's a real tshuka, when there's a real yearning for something. In Parshas Paaloscha, Aaron HaKohen feels bad. 12 Shvatim all brought their karbanos in Chanukah Samigdash, and his shevet was left out. Right? And he looks around and says, you know, because Menashe and Ephraim each count as different Shvatim, everyone gets to participate and not me. And he feels a sense of loss. And he feels a sense, how come I don't get to participate? How come Shevet Levi doesn't get to participate? And Aaron HaKohen He's bothered by this. The first Rashi in Parshas Baaloscha, Lama Nismecha Parshas HaMenorah LeParshas HaNesiim. Why is the Parsha of the Menorah right next to the Parsha of the Nesiim? L'vishek Shara'a Aaron Chanukas HaNesiim Chol Shadaito. When Aaron saw all the Nesiim get to participate, he was feeling sad. Shalohayi Imayim B'Chanukah Lohu V'lo Shvato. That neither he nor his Shevet were able to participate. Don't worry, I have something for you. And that's going to be the taking care of the Neros. The Ramban says, doesn't just mean the Neros in the Mikdash. Neros in the Mikdash means Neros Chanukah. He's referring to the time of the Chashmonaim. That Chanukah of the Chashmonaim was rooted in what? In a sense of Aaron feeling unfulfilled. Feeling that something's not there for me. And that sense of loss, that sense of lacking something, that sense of desire for something, of hoping for something, that's what leads to the story of the Chashmonaim. I mentioned before, I was in Eretz Yisrael last week. Yesterday I saw in our Beis Medrash, in Yeshiva, I saw Rabbi Josh Blass, one of our outstanding mashkichim. And he also happened to have been in Eretz Yisrael. I was there on yeshiva-related business. He was there on a non-YU-related issue. And he said that when he left Eretz Yisrael, he felt such a sense of yearning to be in Eretz Yisrael. And he said that that sense was at the same time challenging and comforting. It's comforting because do we really want to leave Eretz Yisrael and not feel like we want to be there? And not feel like we want to stay? Well, what would that be? That would mean visiting Israel would be like visiting Paris or something. We don't want that. We want to feel that sense of yearning. We want to feel that emotional connection. They say when Rav Huttner made Aliyah, when Rav Huttner moved to Eretz Yisrael, someone asked him, is there anything you're going to miss about living in Chutz Laretz? I don't know, Haagen-Dazs or something. Like, is there anything you're going to miss about living in Chutz Laretz? So Rav Huttner said, yeah, I'm going to miss the sense of yearning to be in Eretz Yisrael. That's what he was going to miss about Chutz Laretz. And there's chachma to that. There's something, obviously it was Rav Huttner, he was a very wise man, but there's something real about that. That sense of yearning builds us. It helps to build that sense of connection. So we turn back to the questions that we began with. Why is the date Chafei Kislev alluded to in the name Chanukah as if that date is so important? Because it is important. That was a date that waited and yearned for 1,000 years. To find its fulfillment. And that date builds the character of Chanukah. Because that's what Chanukah is. It's a yearning and it's a desire for Avodas Hashem. Why was Bezalel correct in building the Ohel first? In reality, he wasn't correct. Moshe Rabbeinu had to pretend that he was correct. Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu was trying to manufacture a sense of desire and yearning in Klal Yisrael. Why did Chagai HaNavi keep emphasizing Simu levavchem al darchechem? Chagai HaNavi was telling Klal Yisrael that what you're doing over here is not just a construction project. After 18 years of not building, after an 18-year stop work order that you had on the Bayusheni, Simu levavchem. Pay attention to what you're doing. Appreciate the chashivas of what you're doing. Because sometimes that's what it takes to appreciate the chashivas or the importance of something. To not have it for so long. And what emerges is that the idea of the Mishkan, the Mikdash, the Chanukas HaChashmonaim, it all related to an unfulfilled and mounting desire. Moreno Rav Willig Shlita, one of our outstanding Rosh Yeshiva, senior Rosh Yeshiva, often says that they say about the Vilna Gaon that it's there's no more apt name for a great person like that than the Vilna Gaon. He says because in Yiddish, Vilnar means to want more, and he says that's what makes a Gaon. What makes a Gaon is if a person is has more desire, more of a wanting to become a Gaon. The idea of Chanukah is that it didn't actually really bring the full Yeshua. Like Chanukah, at the end of the story, the Chashmonaim were still surrounded by people who were going to give them constant battles. It's not really about the accomplishment. It's much more about the Ratzon. I mean, you think about it, Chanukah involved a search for oil. We had to go and search and look. It wasn't just like, oh, here's oil. There was a surge. You know, we think about how our religious lives, how we live our religious lives, and whether do we really have this sense of tshuka, this sense of desire. Rav Druk gave the example that when there's no tachnun in shul, so maybe men can relate to this more than women can on a weekday basis. You know, when there's no tachnun in shul, everybody's happy. Rav Moshe Weinberg once commented, like, you know, you see like men skipping to the train that morning, you know, like, because there was no tachnun. You know, if you're not in shul, you get the impression that tachnun, they put everyone in chains and they start whipping them. And like, what is it? Why are we so happy? Maybe if we appreciated the value of a tachnun, we wouldn't be so happy to skip tachnun. Rav Druk said he was once at the Kotel and there was a rich American there handing out $100 bills. Not a good idea, by the way, but there was a rich American handing out. We have dear friends of ours who we ran into in Israel once in Mea Sharim, and there were these little kids from Mea Sharim that were going around collecting for whatever yeshiva or whatever. So one of our friends took out a $20 bill and gave it to the kid. Within like a minute, she was surrounded by like 1,000 little kids. So this rich American was giving out $100 bills, and people were leaving their minyan that they were in the middle of davening in to go collect their $100 bills. So there were people missing Birchas Kohanim to collect their $100 bills. If we understood how much Birchas Kohanim was worth, we wouldn't leave Birchas Kohanim to go collect a $100 bill. Maybe if we understand, you know, when you're in Israel and you actually daven on a weekday shachris and you get Birchas Kohanim, you know, there are Rabban of Meretz Yisrael that when they come to America will only daven in Sephardic minyanim, because Sephardim do Birchas Kohanim every day. Maybe if we understood the value of all of this Avodas Hashem, we wouldn't be so willing to give it up. This is a beautiful sefer called Otzros HaTorah. It tells the story of a Talmud who was up late at night one night, and he noticed it was a frigid night, and he looked out the window and he saw the Chafetz Chaim wandering the streets late at night, at like 1 or 2 in the morning, on a frigid winter night. And the student happened to have seen the Chafetz Chaim's sister the next day. And he said, "I have to ask you, what was he doing? Why was he out on such a cold night?" And she said, "Oh, he's been out for 3 nights in a row at all hours of the night, because he's trying to see if the moon is visible so that he could do Kiddush Levana." Now, if you're ever in a shul when it's supposed to be Kiddush Levana night on Motzai Shabbos, and the Gabbai announces, "It's too cloudy, there's no visible Levana," look around the room. You're going to see a lot of smiles. You may even see some, "Yes." As if Kiddush Levana is like, Chafetz Chaim was like, they hadn't had an opportunity yet. He went out for 3 nights in a row at all hours of the night, 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning. Maybe Hashem will open up the skies and I'll see a Levana so that he could recite Kiddush Levana. One of my dear friends, Rabbi Nathan Farber, had an idea once. He wanted to write a book. There's a book out there called The Book of Awesome. The Book of Awesome is a collection of things that just, you know, put a little skip in your step, that, you know, just like these little things that happen in life. You know, you're in a traffic jam and then like it opens up, you know, you get right past the accident and like, you know, like you feel like that's like a moment of like, you know, you put on a jacket, you put your hand in the pocket, and there's a $20 bill in there. Yeah, just something that was a nice surprise. All these little things in life that are just awesome. You know, you get to pop the bubbles and then the package comes. I don't know, whatever these are, you know, if that's your thing. Right? You know, these little things. So Rabbi Farber wanted to write the Book of Jewish Awesome. Right? All these little things in Judaism. And then he realized that every single example was not doing a mitzvah. It was when you get to miss Kiddush Levana. It's when it's raining on Sukkah, so you don't have to go in the Sukkah. And it's like, oh my gosh, this is terrible. Right? That shouldn't feel awesome. It should be the Book of Awful, right? Those are we should have a desire. We should have a yearning for serving the Ribbono Shel Olam. Pesach Sheni was one of 4 times that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't know the answer to a question. He didn't know what to do. By Benos Slavchad, he didn't know the din of Yerusha Sabbas. He didn't know what to do with the Megadev. He didn't know what to do with the Mekoshesh. And he didn't know what to do with the people who were Tamei Meis on Pesach Rishon. But only in 2 of those instances did Moshe Rabbeinu actually ask Hashem what to do. when it came to Bnei Slavcha, the Torah says, Vayikrav Moshe es Mishpatan lefnei Hashem, and Pesach Sheni, imdu ve'eshma mayitzava Hashem. Moshe Rabbeinu was a type of Navi that was able to demand a Nevuah. He got Nevuah on demand. He was able to summon a Kodesh Baruch Hu, so to speak, to have a Nevuah. And yet, twice, two out of these four times, he actually asked Hashem what to do, and two other times he just waited. And he didn't directly push Hashem for an answer. Mekoshesh megadev, if he didn't push Hashem for an answer. Why the difference? There's a beautiful sefer that came out last year called Chelkas Binyamin. When Rabbi Binyamin Kamenetsky, Zichrono Levracha, from the founder of the South Shore Yeshiva, my Rosh Yeshiva from when I was a child, when Rabbi Binyamin Kamenetsky passed away, they found piles and piles of like napkins and little papers and response cards where he scribbled down little Divrei Torah. All over the place. Wherever he was, if he thought of something, he just wrote it on where, and they put together a sefer of these Divrei Torah that Binyamin Kamenetsky just wrote on the back of dinner napkins. And it's a two-volume sefer, it's magnificent, called Chelkas Binyamin. In that sefer, and this is where I feel like the five towns and YU and everything connects. Rabbi Binyamin Kamenetsky quotes Hagrid Soloveitchik Zatzal Mi Boston. Quotes the Rav. I don't know, I went to South Shore, I don't remember him ever quoting the Rav. But in the Sefer, he quotes, Hagrid Soloveitchik Zatzal Mi Boston, that the reason Moshe Rabbeinu consulted with Hashem immediately about Bnos Slavcha and about Pesach Sheni was that in both cases, the parties were interested in trying to connect to a mitzvah. Yishuv Eretz Yisrael in the case of Bnos Slavcha, and Karban Pesach in the case of the people who were Tamei on Pesach Rishon. When people express a level of interest, of yearning, of passion, of wanting, of desire, Moshe Rabbeinu responds. He says, that's worthy summoning the Shekhinah for. That's worthy of calling HaKadosh Baruch Hu and saying, Hashem, we need to know what to do. Moshe Rabbeinu reasoned, Halalu Zrizim Heim, V'ro'i Shagam Ani Azareis. They're such Zrizim, they're pushing for something, I'm going to push also. Ani azaris atzmi lishol es pi Hashem ulashivam davar, so I can give them an answer. In addition to certain halachos Moshe Rabbeinu was unaware of, he also had trouble understanding how to implement certain halachos that he did know. The Gemara Menachos Tav Chavtas teaches shalosh tevarim hayu kashin lo l'Moshe. There were three things that Moshe had difficulty with. Ad sheheru lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu be'etzba'o, until Hashem was able to show him with his finger, he's able to point to it. Ve'luhein menorah rosh chodesh ushratzim. So let's focus on menorah because it's Chanukah. Rashi highlights the menorah was made by Hashem. What was Moshe Rabbeinu's big challenge in understanding the menorah? Seven branch candelabra, right? You know, what's so hard about that? They must have had things like that all the time. In that same sefer, Chelkas Binyamin, Rabbi Binyamin Kamenetsky Zatzal explains that the base of the menorah represents the Torah. The kaftorim and the prachim, the flowery designs, represent midos tovos. Moshe Rabbeinu was not confused about how to make a seven-branch candelabra. He was confused how limud haTorah turns a person into a bal midos tovos. How does it happen that just by sitting and learning Torah, you become a better person? And Hashem's response is, throw the gold into the fire. You take that Torah and you instill passion in it. You instill desire. Fire represents passion. And Hashem will help to form that personality. And that's what he did. He threw the gold into the fire and a menorah came out. When we express interest, initiative, passion, desire, we're rewarded with a certain sense of siyata d'shmaya. And that's the way we learn, right? A Gemara has not just a series of halachos, it's a shakla vitaria. There's questions, there's answers, because we need to feel that we're missing something. We need to ignite within ourselves a desire for something, a need for something. And when we manufacture that need, when we build in ourselves that desire, that we've already won, whether we actually achieve or not achieve. Chanukah is not about an achievement. Again, at the end of the day, the Chashmonaim had to fight many, many battles. They were being controlled by Goyim all around them. It wasn't perfect, but it's an achievement because the desire is the achievement. That's what Chafei Kislev is. That's what Chanukah is. And our avoda during this holiday of Chanukah is to build within ourselves a greater passion for Yiddishkeit, a greater desire for Kirvas Elokim, for coming close to the Ribono Shel Olam. Now I'll close with one last idea related to this. There are only two brachos that are midoraisa, that are come from the Torah. The bracha on eating and the bracha on learning. Now, the Torah perhaps is teaching us to recite a bracha on food, because food is the most basic need that can be understood and appreciated by all of humanity. The food experience, because it's a need that everyone has, is a perfect, and by the way, there's more food, everyone should help. But the food experience, when a person gets hungry, it's a perfect metaphor for what the Torah experience ought to be. And maybe that's why God put both of them in the Torah. Had the Torah taught us the bracha on, I don't know, a solar eclipse, we would run the risk of people who are simply not interested or fascinated by it. You know, there are people that like get very excited about things. Got to come outside, got to see what's going to... And other people are like, oh, but the game is on, you know. They're not as interested. But food, the need to sustain ourselves, to nourish ourselves, we know that. We know how desperate we are for that when we are hungry. A nimshal can only be as strong as the mashal. So the Torah chooses the most universally understood and enjoyed mashal, and that is eating. And now we understand what the nimshal is also, the other bracha in the Torah, the other bracha that appears in the Torah, birchas haTorah. Because like food, Torah is something that a Jew needs in order to survive. A Jew should crave it like he is hungry. We cannot imagine going days at a time without food. We should not be able to imagine going days at a time without Torah. We cannot imagine a person saying that he doesn't have to eat because he ate a lot when he was younger. And we should not be able to imagine that a person can say that we don't need to learn because I already finished school when I was younger. We cannot imagine a person saying that he's too busy to nourish his body. We should not be able to imagine a person saying, I'm too busy to nourish my soul. We have that desire. It should be a desire that builds within us to want to come close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to want to come close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Torah. And through that, we should live to see the ultimate Chanukas HaMikdash, which has been building and a desire in us since for thousands of years, and perhaps even in overdrive since the Hakamas HaMedina in the past many, many decades. And we should see all of that come to fruition and appreciate the great gift of Kirvas Elokim.